1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Julius Caesar was the last of a long line of populares. I want to talk about some of the others a little bit. One of the first was Tiberius Gracchus in 133 BC. He was the one who put that great land reform program to give the land back to the small farmers. He was assassinated. He was followed by his younger brother, the brilliant, really the brilliant leader, Gaius Gracchus. And then there were some 10 or 12 others down the line, ending with Caesar and a few others after Caesar, less notable. And almost all of them were murdered. Both the Gracchi brothers were murdered, along with thousands of their followers, by the aristocratic death squads. Other leaders met sudden and untimely deaths, sometimes under suspicious circumstances. We're talking about here almost a century period, 133 to 44. Remember, the numbers go backwards now. We're in BC, in case you were getting confused. What all these leaders had in common was that they challenged the rigged oligarchic system. Even if they broke no laws, they were branded by the nobles and by the gentlemen historians of that day and today as provocateurs who gave affront to sacred custom by unlawfully encroaching on the Senate's domain. Ill-judged and short-sighted transgressors. This is a composite quote from various writers. According to some historians, these popular leaders had to share the blame for their own deaths because they acted in such a rash and provocative way, especially the Gracchi. And this business of blaming the reformers for the homicidal violence that's delivered on them by conservative forces is a time-honored practice. I'm reminded of how a modern-day popular leader, President Salvador Allende in Chile in the early 70s, attempted egalitarian reform in the face of an entrenched military and corporate power, only to be murdered along with thousands of his supporters. And shortly after the military coup, Pinochet's coup, the New York Times editorialized, quote, "A heavy share, get that, a heavy share of the blame for the disaster must be assigned to the unfortunate Dr. Allende himself. A blame for the disaster of all these killings and the murder also of Chilean democracy. A heavy share must go to the unfortunate Dr. Allende himself for pushing a program of socialist reform for which he had no mandate," unquote. In fact, Allende had a sizable plurality. He had won two major national elections, and he had a growing mandate. That's why they had the coup. His percentage of votes in the second election was even higher, I mean, for his Popular Front. But assuming he didn't have a mandate, does that become grounds for giving him a heavy share of the blame for his own murder? The last to be blamed by the New York Times and most of the U.S. press, the last to be blamed for the mass killings were the killers themselves, the Chilean military, financed, trained, advised by the U.S. national security state. For the many historians, getting back to Rome, in whom the ghost of Cicero lives and breathes, the senatorial oligarchs of ancient Rome are not to be blamed at all for the massacres and assassinations they perpetrated. By the way, like every ruling oligarchy in history, the Roman Senate had a long tradition of violating its own traditions and its own constitution when necessity dictated, when class interest dictated. And this brings us to Parenti's second iron rule of politics. Don't ask me what the first is. I just like to call it the second iron rule of politics, which I first, in the first edition of Democracy for the Few back in 1974, I enunciated this rule, and it goes like this. When change threatens to rule, then the rules are changed. And faced with challenges from democratic forces, the oligarchs repeatedly invoked martial law, repeatedly suspended their own constitution, suspended all rights, appointed a dictator, and an Appian's phrase, quote, found salvation in absolute power. All the emperors who came after Caesar wielded substantially more power than he, and yet the senators went along with them. What about that? They're then followed, you know, starting with Caesar's grandnephew, Octavius, later called Augustus, and then called Caesar Augustus, the first emperor, really, and a whole series. centuries of emperors after this, the Senate never complained about their power. They wielded absolute power, like way beyond anything Caesar had. But the senators went along with them because the emperors destroyed whatever power the popular assemblies once had. They initiated regressive taxes and attempted no economic redistribution on behalf of the masses. The Senate, too, was reduced in power. It was reduced to a kind of House of Lords, you know, a lot of prestige but very little power, where these guys could go in and dawdle and sit around and debate. But the important thing was that during the empire, the aristocrats grew still wealthier. In short, when their class interests were at stake, the senators, like elites today, had no trouble choosing political dictatorship over the palest traces of economic democracy. No more than did the Chilean elites in Chile have any trouble siding with Pinochet, even if it meant an end to their own oligarchic rule. When push came to shove, their vast holdings meant more to them than their, quote, republican principles. Their fortunes meant more to them than even their power, as long as they knew that state power was in the hands of someone who was protecting their fortunes. Throughout history, popular leaders, people who have used power to effect some kind of redistribution institutionally, politically, constitutionally, and economically, leaders who have done that throughout history, they have been branded as demagogues and adventurers, motivated primarily by personal ambition. It's not that they wanted the power to end hunger, it is that they just hungered for power. This is the image we get. And this accusation is still leveled today against communists and other revolutionaries and reformers, even by some illustrious people who inhabit the left. Interestingly enough, gentlemen historians seldom raise any question about power hunger in regard to the oligarchic elites, as I already said before, those who actually have state power. What was it these popularities were doing? Listen to what Tiberius Gracchus says in 133, describing the plight of landless commoners, many of whom were army veterans. Quote, "Hearthless and homeless, they must take their wives and families and tramp the roads like beggars. They fight and fall to serve no other end but to multiply the possessions and comforts of the rich." When the Gracchi brothers and other populares, what were the Gracchi brothers and other populares? Were they self-promoting adventurers? Or did they use power as a means of advancing mass well-being? It's not an either-or formulation. It's a little more complex than that. Popular leaders want the opportunity, A, to pursue policies that benefit the common people, as well as, B, win mass support and gain some power because it's needed to challenge the ruling class power and get their policies into operation, and at the same time, C, they might enjoy the personal gratification and glory that accompanies such a risky but popular undertaking. Few leaders are either entirely impervious to popularity or motivated exclusively by its pursuit. Rather than speculating about a leader's motives and personality, I think it's better to inquire into his actual course of action. We need to ask what social forces thrusted these populares to the fore. In Rome, one such social force was the much maligned proletariat. In 50 BC, they gave enthusiastic support to Caesar when he crossed the Rubicon with his legions and returned to Rome from Gaul. In 48, the proletariat engaged in mass agitation when oligarchic magistrates tried to obstruct the implementation of Caesar's debt relief law. After the civil war between Pompey and Caesar, the city crowds pulled down and smashed the statues of Pompey and Sulla. You see, I'm taking these little scraps because this one-sided record of history, we hear very little from down there. But these are indications of what actually was happening there. Plutarch, and most historians have ignored these passages in Plutarch. Plutarch offers a glimpse into the mass support that propelled the Gracchi brothers. When Tiberius Gracchus proposed his agrarian reform, Plutarch writes, "It was above all the people themselves who did most to arouse Tiberius's energy and ambitions by inscribing slogans and appeals on porticos, monuments, and the walls of houses, calling upon him to recover the public land for the poor. Unquote. And when Gaius Gracchus put forth his reform legislation, which was much more comprehensive and brilliant, Plutarch writes, quote, "A great multitude began to gather in Rome from all parts of Italy to support him." I mean, this is a day before there were decent roads, before telephone, before communication, and word got out. All parts of Italy, people came in looking for a better deal, looking to gain and also to give their support to democratic reforms. After the Gracchi were assassinated in 133 and 121 respectively, public acknowledgement of their existence was officially prohibited by the Senate oligarchs. So even then, they were seeking to control historical memory. And yet the common people continued to commemorate the Gracchi brothers. Plutarch offers the following vignette. "The people were cowed and humiliated by the collapse of the democratic cause, but they soon showed how deeply they missed and longed for the Gracchi. Statues of the brothers were set up in a prominent part of the city. Offerings were placed there throughout the year. Many people worshipped their statues as though they were visiting the shrines of gods." Unquote. This all went on despite police proscriptions. In 44, immediately after Caesar's death, the people agitated for guarantees that his land redistribution plan would not be rolled back. And the agitation was enough to compel Brutus to reassure the demonstrators. He gets up to and tries to calm the crowd down, and he says, "The Senate will not tamper with the land reform program." Very grudgingly, you know, he says, "Although that land really belongs to other people and all that, we'll let you keep it. Don't worry." You know, Brutus, by the way, was the one who was dubbed by Shakespeare in his play, Julius Caesar, the noblest Roman of them all. You know, Act 5, the last scene, he says, "And this there lay the noblest Roman of them all." Well, let me tell you about the noblest Roman of them all. He was a key conspirator with Cassius in the assassination of a great leader who loved him, by the way. Julius Caesar loved Brutus, and this reason, one of Caesar's many, many lovers was Brutus's mother. The noble Brutus, let me tell you something else about him. He was a usurer of the worst sort. He lent money to Cypriots at 48% interest instead of the usual 12%. 12% is usury, too, at least by traditional church doctrine. And then he requested that the Roman military come along and help him and his agents collect the money extracted from the Cypriots when they couldn't pay it back. Yet most historians don't think too ill of Brutus. Another conservative senator I'd like to mention to you is Cato. Now, Cato is always praised. He's always described as principled. He was one of the most rigid, the most unyielding, although he could also use bribes in an election to defeat Caesar. He was pumping money in and bribes and saying, well, sometimes it's necessary to do these kind of things. But he always presented as so principled, as so virtuous, you know. In fact, Cato, it's after Cato that the right-wing think tank today, the Cato Institute, is named. Because Cato was supposedly a defender of Republican liberty and opposed Caesar's tyranny. It's very interesting, you know, when left leaders are determinedly, uncompromisingly dedicated to their class struggle, to democratic reforms and such, they're called dogmatic, totalitarian, even Stalinist. That's a favorite term that gets thrown around, all the more useful for being conveniently undefined. When uncompromising conservatives like Cato rigidly adhere to their class interests, they're called principled. Some months ago, I remember I was reminded of Cato. I was sitting, I'd been working, and I wanted to take a break. And a lot of times when I take a break, I relax by reading fiction. So I picked up the New York Times. No, it's true. People ask me, why don't you ever read fiction? Don't you read fiction? I gave you that novel, Enter the Novel, you don't read. I can't get into fiction. I said, I can't get into fiction. I read Dickens, I read Dostoevsky, I read all that when I was like 18. I loved it. I can't read that anymore. And then I realized what the real reason is. I read fiction every day. New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle. I go on, I read fiction. So I was sitting there, and I think of Cato. You know why I think of Cato? Because there's a story about Congressman Sonny Bono, who who encountered a tree that stood its ground. And the obit is saying he was a stalwart conservative with a solidly conservative approach. Solidly conservative. Is that a positive framing or isn't it, you know? I mean, when do we hear of someone being solidly radical or solidly Marxist, you know? By the way, historians who say that we must, to understand an era, we must immerse ourselves into the context of that era completely and see it through the eyes of its participants, such historians often forget that when you do that uncritically so, your chances are you are seeing it through the eyes of the dominant participants. 90% of the primary sources we have on the late Republic come from Cicero. That's why I'm quoting him so often. Cicero. You see the era through the eyes of its dominant class. And you mustn't judge it, therefore? I mean, how far does that work? Do you do that with Nazism, for instance? You say, well, it was the times, you know, that's the way it was in the 30s. You just got to understand it. And don't judge it in any from any critical perspective. Well, this rule of contextual immersion never applies, by the way, to other people in Rome. I never see these historians, for instance, saying, well, there was this riot, but let's understand this riot because these proletarians were struggling for subsidized bread prices. They were struggling for land reform, public jobs. They were struggling for the putting a cap on rents. That's why they rioted. Let's look at them, you know. Let's see what it was about this constitution and its liberties that were really horribly hypocritical and deficient. Instead, the common people are really looked down upon again and again. Cicero was part of an already established tradition when he repeatedly described the urban poor as, quote, the city dirt and filth, the scum from out of the city, unruly and inferior, a starving, contemptible rabble. See, he admits they're starving, and it's their fault that they're starving. This is something about them, obviously. And whenever the people mobilize against class injustice, whenever they go into motion, then they become, in Cicero's mind, that most fearsome and loathsome of all creatures, the mob. And that's a term used by gentlemen historians all the way through. Appian, writing a century after Cicero, describes Caesar as, quote, introducing laws to win the favor of the mob. And the mob he describes as the poor and the hot-headed. In our own day, today, P.A. Brunt refers to the city mob. For Cyril Robinson, the stupid Roman mob, a selfish, good-for-nothing, parasitic mob. Don't hold back, Cyril. For Scullard, it's the idle urban mob. Meanwhile, the aristocratic idlers, the real parasites, who live in obscene opulence, earn not a harsh word from the great majority of these writers. During the early empire, the Roman writer Juvenal spoke scornfully of the mob's preoccupation with bread and circuses. And that phrase has echoed down to us through the centuries, a phrase adding to the image of Rome's proletariat as a shiftless, volatile mass addicted to endless handouts of food and entertainment, free food, free entertainment. Now, elite historians, like all the elites, are always alert to the corrupting influence that state assistance supposedly inflicts upon the poor. Appian tells us that the corn ration attracted the idly destitute and hot-headed elements of the Italian population to the capital. And he contrasts them to those possessed of property and good sense. By the way, this image of an idle mob of layabouts sponging off the state is little more than a figment of upper class and upper middle class prejudice, both ancient and modern alike. It's really interesting to see how many of those who have written about ancient Rome find it so disreputable, so disgusting, that the humble Romans should have been concerned about having enough food for themselves and their children. Oh, they wanted bread. Imagine that. But this hardly makes them materialistic or degraded. In any event, only a very limited number in Rome received the regular corn dole, often with the humble entitled to a smaller share than the more distinguished citizens. Furthermore, man cannot live by bread alone, not even at the physiological level. The proletarians needed money for rent, clothing, and other necessities. Most of them had to find work, low-paying and irregular as it might be. The bread dole often was a necessary supplement. It was the difference between survival and starvation, but it was never a source of total support that allowed them to idle away their days in comfort and leisure. And this raises another question. Who exactly was the mob? It's the same question, by the way, that comes up in the French Revolution. You hear again, the mob, the mob, the mob. There are some writers, Stanley Loomis, for instance, I think in 400-page book, I don't think he ever once called them the crowd, the people, the poor, the mob. It was the mob, the mob, the mob. The mob cheered Robespierre. The mob opposed the aristocrats, the mob. Who are they? Well, what we hear is that they were lumpens, drifters, and riffraff. In fact, closer study reveals that in both Rome of 44 BC and in Paris in 1789 AD, the mob were mainly artisans, craftsmen, shopkeepers, day laborers, respectable and hardworking proletarians. In fact, when there was a mass demonstration, you see, you only get hints of that. All the shops were closed and the shopkeepers were summoned. And the circuses, who went to the circuses? It wasn't just the poor. A higher percentage of the equestrians and the rich and the aristocrats went to the circuses. They had their well-reserved first-tier seats where they can get the best look at all the bloodletting. It wasn't the poor people who created and financed the awful spectacles of the amphitheater. The common people of ancient Rome, like the common people of so many societies, had scant opportunity to leave a written record of their grievances and aspirations. But what little we know of them suggests that the proletariat could sometimes display a social consciousness that was definitely superior to anything possessed by their would-be superiors. Many of them worked next to slaves and were themselves freedmen or the sons of ex-slaves. And most of them were almost as poor as slaves. In 63, during Cicero's witch hunt, several dissenting leaders urged workmen and slaves to take joint action against the oligarchs. Now, such appeals wouldn't be made unless there was an understanding that there was some kind of community of interest between proletariats and slaves. In parts of Sicily, the agrarian proletariat joined in common cause with slaves to rebel against big planters on several occasions. I mean, major rebellions, too. Spartacus. And so we face this largely one-sided recording of what is called history. Cicero, Brutus, and Cato come down to us as the defenders of liberty, when they were something quite the contrary. And Caesar, who did something for the poor and moved against privileged property, comes down to us as an elitist tyrant. And what you've got here, of course, is this confusion of procedural democracy and substantive democracy. That those who cloak themselves in the trappings of procedural democracy or procedural republicanism were definitely against any kind of class democracy or substantive democracy, economic democracy. And those who fought for economic democracy often, because they face a rigged system, often might violate procedural democracy and are immediately labeled as tyrants, power-hungry people. This was true of Caesar, Robespierre, Lenin, Castro, Huey Long, the Sandinistas. We lived through that ourselves. When are they going to have freedom in their country? Ruling elites in America weren't concerned about freedom. They were as hypocritical as the Senate oligarchs were about Caesar. They weren't concerned about freedom. They were concerned that the Sandinistas were actually making changes in the social structure and class structure of Nicaragua. So what we must do is learn to read history against the grain and swim against the mainstream and try to keep connected to those who came before us. Certainly not the Ciceros nor the Catos, as we're urged and trained to do, and not even the Gracchi or Caesar or the Populares leaders, rather the anonymous masses upon whose shoulders they stood, the common people, who struggled against all odds with all the courage and all the fears and all the inconsistencies of ordinary people, who put themselves on the line, whose names we will never know, whose blood and tears we will never see, whose words and cries of pain we will never hear. and yet to whom we are linked in a past that is never dead and never really past, and a future that never arrives but beckons us and keeps us going. And so history never ends, the last page is never written, and the best pages are written not by princes, presidents, prime ministers, popes, or even professors, but by the people. For all their faults and shortcomings, the people are all we have. In fact, we are they. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
You're just listening to Michael Parenti on Class Struggle from Roman Times to Today. He spoke in Seattle in 2008. Michael Parenti is a leading independent political analyst and scholar. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Michael Parenti, Class Struggle from Roman Times to Today, and for the book Socialism Seriously by Danny Katch, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or go on to our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Mike McCormick. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Nina Simone singing the Langston Hughes poem, Backlash Blues.
Second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backlash?